Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello, and welcome to Little Gold. Hey, wait a minute, guys. I don't have to do this anymore. Katie Rich is back.
Hey!
Yay.
Welcome, Katie.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm back with all the scripted intros you could possibly need.
Thank God.
Welcome to Little Gold Men. It's still the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply, and we're still proving that award season is a year-round event. I'm Katie Rich. As previously mentioned, I am back. I'm here with Vanity Fair's digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hi, Katie.
And Vanity Fair's film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And Vanity Fair's senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hello!
Yay! I am back, and I had really great timing, and I went on leave during all of the fall festivals, so I don't know anything about Oscar season, and I'm going to rely on you guys to catch me up, because that's what this podcast is all about. And then after that, we're going to be joined by Molly Shannon, who is the star of the drama Other People, which got rave reviews at Sundance, and is now in theaters and available on demand. But first, you guys talked about the Emmys. The Emmys are a distant memory, but it's never too early to think about next year, and HBO has brought us Westworld, which is their big new splashy series they're hoping will be the new Game of Thrones as that series is ending. Before it can win any Emmys, is it any good? Can you guys let me know if the show is any good?
I like it.
Good.
Yeah, I give it, a pretty positive review on the site.
Well, and you said that the first episode isn't even what's good, which is all the rest of us have seen. How many episodes have you seen?
Four.
Okay.
Four.
And Joanna, you've seen four as well, right?
I've seen four as well, yeah.
Now, Joanna, do you agree with me that three and four are the strongest episodes that we've seen?
I think four is.
Yeah.
I agree about four. Sandy Newton's stuff gets really interesting in four.
Yes.
But I liked it, like Richard did, but I have like a Monuments Valley full of reservations about Westworld. I'm just really nervous. I think I've been burned a lot by these big splashy premieres. I want it to be good, though. Yeah. I really do.
Yeah, Joanna, you have a piece up on the site right now that's kind of about how we have all these shows premiering that say they have an end game and they have the whole thing mapped out, but not many shows have pulled that off, and the creators of this show don't really have a track record with it. So kind of going to something hoping that it's going to be six seasons worth of well-constructed story is maybe a fool's game at this point, since it's like Breaking Bad and no one else who's done it.
Yeah, I mean, so the creators here, we've got J.J. Abrams as a producer, but the main creators are Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan, a married team. If the last name sounds familiar, that's because Jonathan Nolan's the brother of Christopher Nolan and often the screenwriter on his films. And the point I'm just trying to make is that the Nolans are famous for dazzling visuals and really strong performances and complicated high concept things that don't always stick the landing. So I don't know if I'm just like the wet blanket invited to the Westworld party, but I'm just nervous about the amount of mythology they're trying to pull off on this show.
Yeah, and it's a funny thing with this show in particular because, and a lot of people have said this before me, I'm not coming up with this insight fresh right here, but it's kind of meta because it's a show about storytelling and about sort of reality versus expectation and all this stuff. So it feels like it's this kind of reflexive thing of HBO being like, oh, so here's us reflecting on our high concept, big, expensive shows with a show about a high concept, expensive thing.
Theme park.
You know, yeah.
Right.
So it's just kind of interesting. And so I think that any success or failure the show has is just kind of inevitably going to mirror or say something about HBO's and the Nolans. And, you know, I think it's just kind of, it's built that into its DNA, which should be interesting to watch.
Does the mythology get substantially more complex than it is as laid out in the first episode?
It's pretty complex in the first episode.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know that I want any more layers of complexity after that.
Somewhat bigger mystery introduced, although I guess Ed Harris's character in the pilot sort of starts trickling into it with the game and what there's another level to the game. And then another character sort of kind of confirms that.
Yeah, and then there's also like an added layer above it, like the board of directors that was teased in the pilot, but that's like sort of expanded on. And there's three major characters that weren't introduced in the pilot, like three even more characters.
Yes.
Ben Barnes, Jimmy Simpson, and Clifton Collins Jr. They were all added after the pilot, and so they're all introduced in episode two. It's a lot of cast, a lot of plot. Game of Thrones, of course, very famously has all of that too, and people love it.
And they had a pilot that had to be reshot, kind of like the Westworld pilot where they shut down production.
Absolutely. But I guess the point I would make there is that Game of Thrones had a structure laid out by these books, at least for the first, you know, four seasons that were decades of the making. Whereas, you know, this is the Nolans orchestrating this. You know, once again, I'm just your friendly neighborhood cynic here to talk about Westworld. So.
Well, I'm happy to have something that's kind of dense and layered to watch on Sunday nights. Like, I kind of miss that Game of Thrones tradition of jumping into a new world. Like, and even if this isn't as good as Game of Thrones, I think as long as it doesn't become, like, frustratingly bad, I will stick with it. Just, I mean, it's beautiful to look at. The acting's been really interesting. I'm definitely intrigued enough to stick through maybe some Monument Valley-sized problems.
Do they keep doing that Groundhog Day thing?
I hope so.
Every episode?
I really like it.
They do.
Yeah.
That just keeps, that day keeps starting over and over again?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And then you see it the day for other people.
Okay.
And so the next episode, just a little tease, kind of shows you how guests enter the park, like what that process is like, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. I just find the world fascinating. I'm curious to see where they go.
Yeah.
I'm sort of always beating the drum for like miniseries. Like I would watch 10 episodes of this and have a story end. I don't, that's HBO's plan there.
Have they actually said they want 6 seasons? Has that been laid out? Or
5 seasons.
Okay. They plotted out 5 seasons. Yeah. And I agree with you, Richard. I think I would have far fewer reservations if this were a 10 episode miniseries. Yeah. I'd be all aboard for it.
Well, so. Where were you all for the night of then? That was a 10 episode series.
Yeah.
I was there.
Is that, but wait a minute. I just finally finished the night of, and I have a big question. Are they going to come back and do season 2 with the same crime and a different suspected killer?
I think that's it, isn't it?
It's just done. Well,
I think they left the door open.
They did
The British series is multiple seasons. So wait and see, I think, was sort of their approach to it.
Okay.
Man.
I hope not.
Well, real quick from all of you.
We're going to do Eastworld for next season.
Well, and in the books, isn't there like a medieval world and a like pirate world or something? I think in the Michael Crichton book, there's like multiple other worlds you can go
is through. It's not a book. It just says it's based on a film.
It was never a book.
But does that movie even exist? Or
1973?
Yul Brynner. Yul Brynner is the Ed Harris, sort of.
This is the year of remaking Yul Brynner westerns.
Yeah, Yul Brynner in a black cowboy hat.
Who's going to do The King and I?
Yeah. He's really scary in the original Westworld movie. He's like this glitchy, malfunctioning killer robot. But like the original Westworld is very much Jurassic Park, and it's contained. And I just don't know that I want 5 seasons of Jurassic Park. I didn't want 4 movies of Jurassic Park.
And counting.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Real quick from all of you, if you were really rich, would you go to Westworld?
I was trying to think about that, and somebody on Twitter kind of vocalized my... I was like, I would do one if it was like they could recreate like 1970s New York.
Although
1970s New York was terrible for a lot of people, so I shouldn't try to glamorize it.
No, but if nothing bad can happen to you, it would be awesome.
If you could go to like Studio 54 and like hang out with Andy Warhol, that would be fun. That would be more my speed than like, you know,
the old West.
And little
saloons. I would do like 1920s London. That's what I would do.
That's a good one.
This is much more fun than just what I go to Westworld, which I would, by the way, just like hang out in the saloon and like watch people fight. And I mean, I wouldn't kill anybody, just to be clear.
Well,
I might
you
kill
say
some
that
people.
Now.
They're not even people.
I know.
But Mike, that's the whole point.
That's the problem.
They are people.
You are the editors of the situation.
Yeah, yeah.
It's funny. It made me think about my... this is going to sound crazy, but watching it last night, maybe, and then I had to walk the dog, take a break and walk the dog. And I was like, this dog is kind of like the androids. You know, we kind of treat our pets like, you know what I mean? They're just at our service.
Uh-huh.
We kind of, they amuse us. You love your own, but all the other ones you don't really think of as having full inner lives.
I think that about babies a lot of times. I've learned this, that when you have a baby, they're way more interesting than other people. So, yeah.
See that?
Babies and dogs are the androids
babies
of our
actual androids.
Except we don't kill them for sport, as far as I know.
Some people yourself.
Animals, not babies.
So as mentioned, I kind of missed out on all of Fall Festival season, and by reading Twitter, I've caught a few things about what's up and what's down in the Oscar season, but I kind of want to use this opportunity for myself and maybe some listeners who are a little behind, just for some big questions that I need to be caught up on and I need a straight up and down answer. Everybody ready?
Yeah, sure.
Yes.
Okay, a couple movies that came out earlier this year that I don't know if they're done. Light Between Oceans. Did anyone care about it?
Done.
What happened?
It just didn't come together. You know, I
liked it.
I think that movie has its fans, and I like a big portion of it. We had Derek Sinfrentz on the show, and he is such an interesting guy and such a talented filmmaker. It just feels like it's kind of a transition-y movie for him. Like, he's sort of exploring new territory, mm-hmm. and it didn't quite catch with people. But unfortunately, I would say its Oscar chances have sailed.
Fassbender will get that Oscar one of these days.
I mean, you think there's no chance for Fassbender in there?
No.
No.
Harsh.
Even in a weak year.
Just because nobody's talking about it anymore
it
at all.
It came out the wrong time of year. If it had come out maybe November or something, like maybe.
Yeah.
I think Labor Day release, that's pretty rough.
Okay, speaking of release dates, Florence Foster Jenkins came out in August. Is Meryl Streep still in it?
Can never count her out.
Okay.
Hugh Grant, right, is like the thing that we think might happen.
Oh, nice. Yeah. That's exciting.
I think that probably, especially because, you know, the male fields are a little bit empty right now.
Okay.
Well, I have no evidence for this, but I think Isabelle Huppert is going to take the Meryl Streep slot, or very much could.
Yeah.
Well, you're leading me into my next question, which is that I keep hearing Best Actress is super stacked.
Yes.
So what's happening there? Why are we so excited about Best Actress?
Well, I mean, there's Isabelle Huppert, who has two great movies this year, Emma Stone and La La Land. Potentially, we talked about this last week, about the Fences trailer, Viola Davis
is still deciding which award she wants.
She's just sort of sitting back in her chair being like, do I want... Mm-hmm. She's mapping. If you win for supporting, what does your career become?
Right. Yeah. She's running all that through the algorithm.
Yeah. She's in there. Natalie Portman for Jackie's in there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just, there are a lot of big performances in movies that are pretty highly regarded. So I think that's kind of why the focus has been on that. You know, compared to last year where the whole thing was Leo, and, you know.
Oh, Amy Adams, too, for
Arrival. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which has yet to be released, but everyone at festivals have seen it.
It's really good.
Played really well. And, mm-hmm. Yeah,
so Best Actress is stacked, and Best Actor is looking relatively thin by comparison.
It is thinner. Although, I got to say, we were talking about this last week. And, you know, you got Denzel for Fences. You've got Ryan Gosling for La La Land. You've got Casey Affleck, who we were saying, oh, poor Casey Affleck, like maybe even the best performance of the year. But since he doesn't have quite the same star power, he might not be able to. But then I watched it. I don't know. I know a lot of people have seen it, but I don't know. This movie is so good. I think I might just beat the drum for Casey Affleck through the rest of the thing. It's very me. It's like a, you know, Irish Catholic guy dealing with a lot of internal torment or whatever. I fall for those kinds of things. But it's unbelievably good, this performance.
Well, it's an Amazon movie that's not on Amazon, so I have no idea when I'll get to see it.
Mm-hmm. What else is in actor?
Well, Denzel, you know, there are a couple
not
of
Fassbender
movies.
Apparently has no chance, even though we can't think of the fourth and fifth.
There are some movies coming down the pike that could be, like Scorsese has
Silence.
I think Neeson will be supporting for that, but Andrew Garfield has that and Hacksaw Ridge, Mel Gibson's movie, which was really well reviewed by Venice. And then there's this movie Gold, this mysterious Stephen Gagan movie with Matthew McConaughey with weird bald head. It's a very kind of like transform performance. Who knows about that? I did speak to someone who saw it yesterday, and I heard some interesting things that I probably shouldn't elaborate on. But
well, you got Tom Hanks for Sully, you got Michael Keaton for The Founder, you got Joel Edgerton for Loving.
Yeah,
I was gonna say Michael Keaton is like a weird conversation that like peaked early. And then we're not talking about it now. I mean, The Founder still hasn't come out, but
yeah, because it was supposed to come out earlier in the year, and then they moved it
right to increase the Oscar chances. Mm-hmm. So I feel like We shouldn't sleep on Keaton.
There's definitely part of my brain that thinks he won an Oscar for Birdman. Like, I kind of forget that it didn't happen. So maybe, I don't know if that helps or hurts him in this situation, but he's definitely in there. Well, I was going to ask about Sully because it's this crazy huge hit. And the last time Clint Eastwood had a big hit, it was American Sniper. And my theory is that if the Oscars were held a month later that year, American Sniper would have won Best Picture. So should we be watching out for Sully?
I think, yeah, there could be a Sully surprise. I think that, especially now that
as a flock of geese.
Yeah, well, but in a good way. You know, I think the finances on that, like the box office really helped that movie a lot.
Yeah.
And it's a solid movie. I mean, he's really good in it. It's small, though, even though it's about this crazy thing. It's not like a huge, expansive story.
I feel like Hanks could get a nomination that's sort of like the Cranston Trumbo nomination, where we're all kind of like, okay.
Sure.
Like, that's a great actor.
There's a lot of older folks in the voting body. Let's just put it that way. You know, we have to keep that in mind.
So the thing that always surprises me that Tom Hanks didn't get nominated for Captain Phillips, in which he was incredible. So you think that Tom Hanks is a slam dunk, but it kind of seems like he can miss somehow.
Yeah. I mean, it does happen. There is precedent because of the Captain Phillips kind of upset.
Yeah, that was really crazy.
That's what I mean sort of by the Cranston nomination is like Tom Hanks is always so solid, but never... You know, recently, never very flashy. So I feel like we could get like a solid nomination versus a like, oh my God, Michael Keaton and Birdman. Where did this come from?
Tom Hanks hasn't been nominated in 15 years. It's kind of crazy.
Wow.
He's been busy making that Da Vinci Code money.
Well, I was going to say, we're forgetting Inferno, guys. It's coming out later this fall.
Well,
you're right. I mean, if not for Captain Phillips, what could do it? I mean,
I
that scene at the end of the movie where he breaks down, that's just like a classic Oscar audition tape.
Yeah.
Except it didn't feel like that, which is all the more reason.
Yeah.
Well, what can you do?
Well, last question, speaking of Inferno, what's the big one on the horizon that we're looking for that's going to like upset the whole thing? Last year, there were like four movies coming out in December that everyone was waiting for. Is it Silence? Is it Passengers?
I think it's a movie that I'm seeing not this coming Friday, but next Friday, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk.
At the New York Film Festival, right?
I think that could be a real game changer. Either way, either it plays weird and it's on this crazy frame rate and it's like a kind of a technical experience apparently in addition to this war drama, but I don't know. I think Life of Pi was such a kind of sneaky, it won him Best Director. Like, I don't think we can ever count him out or his movies out, so I'm really excited for that movie.
Yeah,
and I think that's my kind of most anticipated.
Mike, what about you?
I don't know. I think Passengers looks like it'll be a good movie and make a lot of money.
Like,
but I don't. Yeah, I'm not getting a this comes in and mixes up the Oscar race feel off of it. I don't know. I'm excited to see Billy Lynn. That's for sure. I don't know. It's hard to
Joanna?
Say.
I'm going to go back to the founder and Keaton. Keaton with the spotlight and the Birdman, you know, Oscar track record. That's what I'm going to go with.
All right. And now we're going to welcome Molly Shannon, who is the star of the movie Other People that premiered at Sundance earlier this year and is now available on demand in theaters. Molly is obviously famous for her stint on Saturday Night Live, but as we talked to her, she's had a really interesting career since she left that show in a lot of different comedies and dramas. And this movie is another one that really proves the dramatic chops that she has that, as she says, was always visible there even when she was playing Mary Catherine Gallagher and sticking her hands in her armpits.
Here's a fun topic. Cremation.
Oh. I'm not gonna, we talked about this.
I know we talked about it. I just want to.
I'm not going to be burned up, okay? I don't. How would you like it if somebody set you on fire? No, thank you.
Well, it's not like they light you. You know.
I don't like camping, and I don't like fires, and I don't want to be personally lit on fire. I want to be frozen. Do they have that as an option?
How you doing, Sacramento? City boy in the house. You're not too good for us now, are you?
I'm glad that you're moving home for a bit. Your mom's gonna need a lot of help.
Don't look at us. We're drug addicts.
I thought you didn't want to try medical marijuana.
Well, I tried it.
I read your letter.
Please put Dono outside. I can't stand to see him licking his penis.
Dono, stop it.
One by one.
Does anybody have any questions about what's going on with Mom?
I still love you.
When I die, you gotta live your life. Except you can't date anyone for a year. And you can't date that slut who came to the door today.
When it's all said and done.
I wish we could just travel the whole world real quick. So you could just see everything.
I get to see my whole world at dinner tonight. All I ever wanted was to be a mother.
And oh, my darling.
I thought when your mom dies, you get that beautiful revelation about life. And just everything becomes clear.
Because nothing.
So it just feels like something that happens to other people.
Oh, but nothing takes the place of you.
Yeah, well, now you're other people to other people.
So, Molly, between this and Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, you've had kind of two huge Sundance hits in a row, which is a really, probably a rare feat. Does it feel as amazing to be in the middle of something like that as it seems from the outside?
It really does. I couldn't believe it. You know, both of those movies premiered at the Echo Theater. I forget which nights they were. Maybe they were both.
Other People was the opening film.
That wild? Yeah, Other People was the opening film. Okay. So, yes, I feel really, really lucky. And it's interesting, too, that there's death in both of those movies. In the one movie, I play the mother to a dying girl. And then in the other movie, I'm playing a woman who is dying. So I feel really fortunate. And I've said this before, you know, I feel so grateful to Mike White, because I think I got offered these parts because people really do love my work in Mike White's movies. And I think Mike showed people that I can do drama and comedy because he knew me. We're really good friends in real life. So he was able to really write for me. But a lot of those directors would quote in their letters when they were offering me parts, they would say, I really love you in You're the Dog, or I love you in Enlightened and Saturday Night Live. But I just like to always just say how grateful I am to Mike White that he kind of showed people that I could be dramatic.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to take credit for anything, but, you know, when you would do the Mary Catherine Gallagher serious monologues from, like, movies of the week, like, I was like, oh, wait, she can actually do this. Like, this is not, you know, because you started as a dramatic actress, didn't you? I mean, at NYU?
I did. Thanks for saying that. I like that you referenced the monologues, because those monologues were so serious to me. So when people think of me just as a comedian, I'm like, those Mary Catherine Gallagher monologues are like, oh, mama. And I always wanted them underscored with music. It was like drama and heart and tragedy. And it was like I poured my heart out. You know, even though it's a character and it was on a comedy show, those were very dramatic monologues. And yes, I went to NYU Drama School and I started out doing monologues, you know, with a southern accent with mama in them. So mama. I did a lot of that before I got on Saturday Night Live. I remember when I was first starting, I memorized a monologue from The Twirler. It was like about a baton twirler, you know, and I used to do that all around town for agents. I would in that dramatic monologue to try to get signed by an agent. And yeah, so I was just a regular drama student at NYU.
So when you, I mean, you have this long legacy on Saturday Night Live and you've been doing this dramatic work, but when you're getting cast in things, when it's not people writing letters to you who've seen The Year of the Dog, do you find that you have to be like, no, I can do this? Is there kind of that idea that you're just a comedic actress, or has that gone away, you know, 10 years after Year of the Dog was made? Have people kind of gotten the message?
I feel like people have kind of gotten the message. That's really nice, but I do feel that way. But I mean, let's see, those are different audiences that see those movies. So I definitely have people that just know Saturday Night Live, you know, and then I have other people that, I think because I get recognized, you get to see the different types of people that see your work. So some people only know big comedy stuff, and then some people know both. It just depends on the type of fan. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And then there's some people that have only seen me in Little Man, and that's also a compliment. You know, like there's all different types of people. But I would generally say that people kind of do know that I do both now, I think, and I feel so happy about that.
Is there one movie that you hear about more than anything else?
I would definitely say Superstar. Superstar I hear about a lot, like every day of my life, I would say. All the time at Starbucks, you know, it's like, it seems to appeal to like everyone, like airports, all different age brackets. So it's really great.
So Chris Kelly, who is the writer and director of Other People, is now the head writer of SNL. So I have to assume that was an automatic point of connection for you guys. Is that how you wound up working on this, or did you just kind of like have a ton to bond over when you were working on the movie?
Yeah, it's funny. We had never met, even though, yes, he's the head writer of SNL, but we never met at the show. I was at the scene there. I met Kate McKinnon and Edie, and I saw all these people, but I didn't meet Chris. So when Other People came around, he just offered it to me. I think his story is that he would always, when he was pitching, he would say, and you know, I'd like somebody like Molly Shannon to play my mom. But he didn't, I think he didn't know if he could get me or if I was available or I don't know. But he said he would always mention me. And then I just got the script. The financing came through pretty quickly. It was in the summertime. And I just, they were like, read it now and let us know if you want to do it. And I read the script in my bedroom, and it it took my breath away. I really have never had that kind of feeling reading a script. It just really pulled at my heartstrings. And I really, as a mother in real life, I really related to the mother character. And I love her relationship with the son. And the script just leapt out at me. I was like, oh, are you kidding me? I feel like I'm dreaming. Like, I'm getting offered this part? Like, it just, I was so excited. And I've never so quickly called somebody on the phone. I called them like 2 minutes later. I called Chris. He was on his way to, like, the correspondence dinner. He was in New York, and I was in L.A., and I called him, and I said, I would love to do your movie. And he was like, you would? Really? He seemed kind of, like, surprised and in shock, and I was like, yes, yes. And so we started shooting quickly after that because, like I said, the financing came together really quickly. And I was so excited that I had to go running for about 45 minutes. I ran myself around my neighborhood like a dog because I was so excited. I was like, I can't believe I'm going to be in this movie. And I would replay the scenes in my head. Like, this was, like, my fantasy about all I ever wanted, like, to be in a movie like this and, you know, becoming an actress. And I just felt like, wow, I can't believe this is happening, you know?
So then if we can rewind back to January when it premiered at Sundance, and it was so rapturously received, and I think your performance in particular got so much praise. Did that feel like a confirmation of something, or was it an entirely new kind of surprise and excitement?
It just felt like an entirely new kind of surprise and excitement. I really just wanted to do a good job for Chris because I like him so much, and he's like such a nice person, and he's so humble. And I just felt like, I was like, I can't believe this young kid, you know, Chris is young, and he's a comedy writer, and I couldn't believe for his first screenplay he wrote this, like, vulnerable, moving, complicated family, emotional comedy. I was like, how did he do that? I just admire his bravery so much that really all I was thinking about was really wanting to do a good job for Chris. And, like, is that right? Like, really wanting to, and, you know, it's not a docudrama. He's not like, no, that's not how my mother did it. You know, he wanted the essence. You know, he wanted to hire also comedians to keep the balance, too, between comedy and drama, not let it get too heavy. But I really was just thinking about Chris. So then when people were saying really nice things about my performance, I was so surprised. I was like, wow, I did not expect that at all. I just mostly wanted to make sure Chris was happy with it and that I did a good job kind of getting her essence and her spirit and what she cared about and her values and her complicated relationship with her son. I just wanted to do a really good job because I felt so lucky being given that material. You know, so I didn't expect anything beyond that. I didn't even think about anything more than that. Just wanting to do, like, a good job on set that summertime when we shot it.
Yeah. It's a very motherly attitude you have. It's like you adopted Chris as your own child by playing a version of his mom.
Oh, well, you know what? He's just such a nice person, and I truly am, like, you feel his heart in the movie. I feel like I could cry. I feel like he's such a good person, and he's, like, so humble, and I just feel like he did such a beautiful movie, and it's very universal because it's about family, and the son is gay, and it's complicated, and the father's not accepting his sexuality, and the mother feels between the husband and the son, but yet she's slipping away. Her life is being cut short, and I think, you know, having lost my mom at a really young age, I, like, deeply, deeply related to the material and, like, what a mother would do for her children and how she would do anything to buy for time, like, brutalize her body and just, like, fighting for time to make it to these things. I just so deeply related to the material and was able to put, you know, my own stuff in it with also wanting to honor Chris's mom and Chris. And so it was just so special for me, like, certainly such a highlight in my career.
So as you were saying, there's all this, you know, really heavy stuff with the cancer, but he also cast all these comedians to try to bring some levity to it, you know, as there would be in real life. And one of the pleasures of watching the movie is every scene seems to bring a different actor or comedian you know from something. And I wonder, you know, you have this state in the comedy community. Like, did you know a lot of these people already, or were you meeting some of these up-and-comers for the first time, or a combination?
I met some of those up-and-comers for the first time, and they got so many good actors. I tell Chris, like, I'm like, oh, my God, I love all these people, like, Zach Woods and John Early and I don't know the kid's name who was in the scene with the supermarket when he recognizes the kid from Sacramento who he knew from years ago who was like, I heard about your family situation. That's like one of my favorite scenes too. Paula Pell and I worked together at Saturday Night Live. She's the one with the stick that cures cancer. She's, you know, she's just a powerhouse writer at Saturday Night Live for years and movie writer. Let's see, who else did I? Maude Apatow I never worked with. No, I think most I kind of just met on the set, you know, Lennon, who was so good playing the teacher.
Yeah.
I might have seen them briefly, like at parties, but I didn't know them well. So it was just such a fun set because you're with so many super talented comedians. Carrie Kinney, we shot those scenes, you know, like all in one or two nights, the New Year's party scene. So it was such a fun set because it's all these great comic minds.
J.J. Toto, you'd known for years, though, of course.
J.J. Toto and I go back such a long time. Yes, how did you know? No, yeah, J.J. Toto, isn't he incredible?
Yeah. Yeah, he was very much the scene stealer at Sundance. Like, I think he came out after the show. Like, when you guys came out on stage, the audience was really into him, which was fun to watch.
This is the kid who plays Justin, I'm assuming.
He's so fantastic. Well, the real story about that is that, I'm not sure if you guys heard this, but he came in for the audition with Pris and Naomi Scott and Adam Scott, our producers. And in real life, he said, I'm so sorry I'm late for this audition. I'm doing a full redeck on my bedroom, and I'm using Cuero marble. And Chris was like, oh my god, this kid cannot be for real. This is like, I couldn't find a better character than this. So, because originally the character was supposed to be, it was written differently, and then they opened it up wider to see more different types of kids. So they changed it, and then Chris just thought, he's the guy, he's the one. And Chris took him out for lunch and wrote down everything he was saying, because he was like, these are just gems. I'm going to put this in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you can tell it feels like a very organic kind of...
Yeah, you know that kid can't have been cast to, like, do the... Like, he has to be like that in real life. There's not... Yeah. It's too authentic to be faked.
Exactly, yes. I love when he's like, come here. No, please, I have work to do. I like the way he moves his arms. I mean, he's just naturally funny, too, you know?
Yeah.
Please, go. I could watch it over and over again.
He seems like he might also have some southern-accented monologues with mama in him at some point. You know,
I know, doesn't he?
Like a Beth Henley play is in his future.
Like a one-man performance of the Glass Menagerie.
Yeah. But you're right. He is the sweetest. Like, he'll do anything you want. I was like, JJ, can you make a video for my kids? And he's like, hi, Stella, Nolan. You know, he's just sweet, and he loves show business. He's like, he's just adorable.
Yeah. If we could shift gears for a second to Divorce, because that show is premiering on Sunday, and you're a big part in that.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to that and like what, because you're kind of movies and TV, you've sort of straddled both. Like, is there a strategy there, or is it just kind of the best material, whatever the platform is?
Yeah, there isn't really a strategy. I would say, the best material. And let me think. I mean, my dream was always cable because I love the writing and the schedule is great for a mom. I mean, if you could get that, but of course I was willing to do anything. But I just think there's so much fantastic writing on television now. And when I read that script, I was like, wow, Sharon Horgan, she's amazing. And I'm a fan of hers. I just think she's so talented. She's from Ireland, and she's just like a powerhouse. I think that she has her finger on like the pulse of writing about women in a really honest way, infidelity, marriages, complications. I was like, wow. Because I've seen versions of that story of couples in conflict, but it tends to be too silly, and I don't like that, because I feel like it's so rich with, it's like a comic gold mine, and I think that you can make it funny, but you have to keep the emotional stuff true, and I think she does a brilliant job of that. And Paul Sims, our co-executive producer, and then we have this great group staff of writers. So when I read it, I was like, wow, this pilot twists and turns and surprises you. And I really I think she's amazing. And I think that you find yourself siding with one character, then moving toward another, and you kind of switch alliances halfway through. And she just does a really good job of that. She's a really honest writer and a brave writer and like a real force to be reckoned with, I think. Sharon Horgan. So yeah, so when I read that, and I was like, this is good. Ooh, this is juicy. This is like a show I would watch. So I just felt lucky to be asked to read for it. And I knew Sarah Jessica Parker already from New York City. We knew one another socially because Matthew Broderick and I had worked together in The Music Man, and we used to live in the same neighborhood. So I love Sarah, and she's just the best, and she's just like, you know, Hollywood royalty, an elegant class act. And I was a huge fan of her from Sex and the City. I think she's such a good actress. And she's just like a really considerate person who's always interested, like, how are you, asking you about yourself. So I felt so lucky to get that part. I think TV sometimes takes a while to like figure out the tone and the characters and how to write for them. Like, so I'm very like, I guess I'm like, I approach it like business-like, like, well, I hope I can keep being written in and this would be so great if this could keep working. But because I was on SNL for a while, I understand that these things are a process and they take time to figure out. And I feel really lucky to be a part of it.
What did SNL teach you about that process? Because that show seems so different from something like Divorce. It's like a scripted cable series.
It is so different. I think because SNL is such a writing job, I wrote a lot of my characters. You have to write your way to get on air. So I come from more writing background. And I think that I'm always looking at, you have to kind of slowly show them what you can do and, you know, kind of establish your character. And that doesn't just happen overnight. I think that's why TV is tough, because sometimes if something right out of the gate doesn't do well, it can be quickly canceled, whereas it really takes like a staff and the cast a while to kind of figure itself out. So it's nice if there's that time to kind of develop and then like get it, you know? So I think HBO is great that way. They seem to really give shows a chance. And so I guess I just more think about the writing and like just really patient with the writers of like, okay, good, I hope they can slowly figure out my character. And, you know, Sarah Jessica and Thomas Hayden Church are the central characters. They have to do the heavy lifting, but then we're the side ones. And more thinking about the writing of it, like understanding what they have to do to establish the main characters and try to not be selfish and just think of my part and just think of the show as a whole. That helps me. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So now that you've been working with Tracy Letts on the show, is there any chance he might write some really juicy theater role for you? Kind of an August Osage County style,
that would be,
I don't
amazing.
Know, family
I
drama?
Love that question. Well, that would be amazing. It's so funny. On the show, they let him improvise sometimes, and I'm like, he's the best improviser because he just writes so well. So it's so fun when me and Tracy are a couple fights. He will just say the best thing just off the top of his head. So that would be wonderful. I would love that.
You might finally get your big mama monologue.
Boy, he would be the best one to write it, right?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, mama, I know. That's so great.
So I guess one last question before we let you go. Saturday Night Live during election seasons tends to be kind of at the forefront of all conversation. Do you tune in like the rest of us when it's election season, kind of dying to see what's going on, or are you a regular watcher?
I do. I tune in. I love it. I'm still really close to Lorne Michaels. He's just the best. And I tuned in to the season premiere, and I thought it was excellent. I was like, wow. You know, I thought that Alec Baldwin was fantastic. Well, of course, Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider, this is their first year as head writer. So I just thought the show was really fresh. I thought it was excellent. I watch every week. I love the girls. I think they're so strong. I love this cast. I think they're great.
I really can't wait to see if they have someone playing Tim Kaine if they do the VP debate. I don't really know what you do with it, but it's a big comedy challenge.
I know. It's so fun to see who's going to get cast as what. And, you know, it's really very exciting. But I thought they handled it so well. And it was so good that they had the debates before the first show. It was perfect timing.
Yeah. No, it's almost like the debate commission kind of knows SNL's schedule. And it's like, okay, we'll do this to get the maximum level of attention.
Exactly. They all watch. All those politicians watch SNL. I remember when I was on it. They're all very aware of what's going on.
Well, yeah. Molly, thank you so much for joining us. And congratulations on Other People. You know, it's available for lots of people to watch. So it seems like it's going to, like You're the Dog, it's going to keep getting discovered more and more by people as they find out how great it is.
Oh, that's so nice. Thank you so much.
So before we go, one more chance to catch me up on the Oscar race. What's the state of the best supporting actor? Who's going to win if you had to do it right now?
If I had to do... Hugh
really
Grant,
put the
man.
Pressure on.
I've been rooting for him since I saw the movie back in like July or June.
Mm-hmm.
He's so good in Florence Foster Jenkins, and it's such a nice kind of comeback-y... And it's not like a comeback like he was out of work. He chose not to act much, you know, for like most of the aughts. So yeah, I would say that. But, you know, sight unseen... Joe Reed, friend of the podcast, has this intuition, and he's rarely wrong, that Liam Neeson could win for Silence.
Oh, yeah, I like that
theory.
Because
he's never won an Oscar.
Which is crazy.
You know, and he missed his chance for Lincoln, because he was originally going to play Lincoln, and then kind of dropped out. And then Daniel Day-Lewis won it. So, I don't know. I would say that between those two.
I'm just looking. I often cheat during this segment. And I'm looking at Gold Derby to see what people have. And I'm surprised pleasantly, and I like it, is Mahershala Ali from Moonlight.
Oh,
it's on a lot of people's lists. And that's one of the movies I've actually seen. Mm. And he's freaking amazing.
And he's having such a year. I mean, with Luke Cage and other things, like, and he's in Hidden Figures, I believe, like coming up. So
yeah. So I like that one. I'm gonna plunk down for that.
Joanne, how about you?
They stole my answers.
With
Mahershala Ali. But I will do my dad's vote instead because he asks me every day, which is Jeff Bridges in Hell or High Water, which I don't think is going to happen.
Seen Hell or High Water, and one of the things I've seen. He's very good in it, but doesn't.
My dad really wants an Oscar for Jeff Bridges for Hell or High Water, so that's the dad vote.
And when talking about this category, we should be clear. We don't know yet if the geese from Sully are running into actress or actor. We don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
So that clearly.
Did they get their SAG card so they could qualify?
Yeah. So they're SAG-AFTRA now, and you know.
But I tell you who's popping up a lot as well is Steve Martin for Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk.
Heard whispers about Vin Diesel in that movie, same movie.
But has anyone actually seen it? I thought no one's seen it. So people are just kind of like Steve Martin is like a man of a certain age,
it's a prestige movie.
It's classic.
He hosted the Oscars not long ago.
Uh huh.
Yeah, tune in 2 weeks from now. I guess you guys will have a lot of. Intel for us on that.
Yeah.
Rich and I are spending Friday evening together watching Ang Lee's whatever technology.
Long halftime screening.
That does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thank you so much for listening and for having me back. Please rate and review us on iTunes if you get the chance. It helps us find new listeners and we appreciate it. And we're all writing about award season and all the rest of it at vanityfair.com. We're all on Twitter at Little Gold Men, and individually I'm at Katie Rich. Richard?
Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And Mike?
Mike _ Hogan.
And Joanna?
Joe wrote this.
This episode was produced and edited by Alana Milner, and thanks to Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply. And this week's award for the best Hillary Clinton response to the vice presidential debate goes to Mike Hogan.
Just running all that through the algorithm.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.